I guess then we just wait for the music.
Yeah, as we always do. Wait for the damn. Oh, there it is. There it is. What was I saying about the music? I wasn't saying anything about the music. Hey, everybody, I'm Kai Ryssdal. Welcome back to Make Me Smart. None of us is as smart as all of us on this podcast.
Indeed, and I'm Kimberly Adams. It's Tuesday, which means it's time to do a deep dive into a single topic, and today we're going to talk about the national debt.
Now, you may or may not have, depending on how closely you follow this kind of stuff, been aware that the limit on the national debt went back into effect on late Saturday night, 31st of July, mm-hmm. a two-year moratorium or relaxation or what have you on the amount of money that the United States government can borrow went back into effect. So now the national debt is something like, I don't know what, $28 trillion. And that's where it mm-hmm. stands until Congress does something else. And we're going to talk about that today.
Right. And so it is expected to grow from that $28 trillion to $35 trillion by the end of 2031. And we'll probably get into why we set these time limits for how we think about the debt. But those numbers come from the Congressional Budget Office. And it is always some kind of political drama about whether or not to raise the debt limit.
Frankly, I look forward to it. It's one of those regular items of coverage. You're like, oh, yeah, here we go again. I know this story. Anyway.
I don't look forward to it.
Megan Green, who you can hear chuckling there in the background, is an economist, also a senior fellow at Harvard's Kennedy School, and she is going to help us understand, number one, what the debt is, how big a deal it is, and what we might ought to want to do about it. Megan, thanks for coming on.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So look, $28 trillion is a boatload of money, and let me try to relate this in regular household terms, which is the comparison that always gets made, even though it's false. How worried ought we be as a country about $28 trillion worth of red ink?
Look, so we've got a lot of debt. We've just come off the back of an unprecedented crisis. So we've accumulated a whole bunch more debt as a result of that. And the debt is just the stock of everything we've borrowed over time and haven't yet paid back. And so you need to worry about that at some point, because if investors don't think you're going to pay it back, they won't lend to you anymore, and then you won't be able to pay your bills. So the government won't be able to provide normal services, for example. But the U.S. has more space than any other country for two main reasons. One is the U.S. has a global reserve currency, the U.S. dollar. So there's sort of an insatiable demand for U.S. dollar-denominated assets. And secondly, the U.S. Treasury market, which is how the U.S. government borrows, is the deepest, most liquid asset class in the entire world, which just means that it's much easier to buy and sell treasuries. And so that means that the point at which investors get really worried about lending to the U.S. government and never getting their money back gets pushed off further into the future. So I would say the U.S. doesn't need to worry nearly as much as any other country for these two unique reasons. I would also say economists are looking at debt really differently now from how they always did. Mm-hmm. So we always used to look at a figure debt to GDP, which is the stock of all the debt you've borrowed relative to how much you're growing every year, because you can grow your way out from under a debt burden. If you're growing, you can use that money to pay down your debt. And debt is a stock, but GDP is a flow. And economists never compare stocks to flows.
Stop.
Yeah.
You got to do the stock flow thing.
Yeah. So debt is a stock. And a stock is like how much money you have, how much water you have in a bathtub. And GDP mm-hmm. is a flow. It's like how much water is flowing into the bathtub mm-hmm. at any given point in time. And so you can't really compare stocks to flows. They're related clearly, but it's like comparing apples and oranges. And yet somehow economists have always compared this debt to GDP, this stock to a flow. And so more recently, economists are starting to think about debt differently and thinking, well, we should compare things in like terms. We should look at flows to flows instead. And if you do that, you look at borrowing costs, so how much you're accruing to service your debt at any moment in time relative to GDP, which is how much you're growing at any point in time. And because borrowing costs are so incredibly low, largely because central banks have cut rates so low, then actually that ratio, borrowing costs to GDP, is much lower than the debt stock to GDP. And if you look at it in those terms, in borrowing costs to GDP, actually the figure is much less scary, and we don't need to worry as much.
So if I understand that correctly, it's sort of rather than comparing, you know, I owe $100 to, you know, I'm getting more money every year. It's I owe $100 and the interest on that is 5%, but I'm making 5% more every year. So it doesn't matter.
Yep, that's right. So you're not paying that much to have borrowed that money anyhow, and you're growing. So you don't need to worry. Where this all falls apart, of course, is if your borrowing costs spike all of a sudden. So we don't need to worry as long as borrowing costs are really low and as long as we're growing, and we are growing in the U.S. But if borrowing costs were to jump all of a sudden, then we could have a problem in the U.S. And so as we're thinking about, well, what would make those borrowing costs jump all of a sudden? And one answer is something a lot of people are worried about right now, which is inflation. Yeah. So if we got sustained, significant price hikes in the economy, then the central bank might feel like they have to hike rates to push against that inflation, and that would cause borrowing costs to go up. And then our debt gets much more expensive to service. And so then that ratio borrowing costs to GDP looks a bit more scary.
What happens if Jay Powell is wrong? If inflation is not transitory, that these price increases that we've been seeing the last number of months stick with us, and then the Fed has to raise rates, borrowing gets more expensive, our debt becomes harder to handle, then what happens?
So then you'll see some stress in a lot of debt markets, but probably not the U.S. government debt market as much as corporate debt markets, for example. So a lot of companies that have borrowed a ton and it's been really cheap, so that's been fine, might get into trouble, might be insolvent, might have to default. The U.S. government, like I said, has a bit more leeway because it has the global reserve currency and because it's such a big, deep, liquid asset class that everyone wants to be involved in. That the U.S. should have more space, the government should have more space, even if borrowing costs go up. People often ask me, what level of debt do we need to worry about? Yeah. Where's the trigger point? And unfortunately, there isn't a level of debt that's a trigger point. If you look at when Argentina defaulted, its debt was around 47% of GDP. Same with Ireland. When they got into really big trouble in the 2000s, their debt burden was really low as well. So a lot of it is not a magic number, but more sort of how investors feel about the government's creditworthiness, how likely it is that they'll be paid back. And there's a lot of trust in the U.S. government. Will there always be trust? Probably not. There could be a point at which investors decide, no way are we lending to the U.S. government. But I think we're a really long way off from that.
I love how all of this is dependent on the emotions of investors.
Right. Yeah.
Yep. Economics always comes down to people.
More serious question. You've mentioned a couple of times that economists used to think about debt one way and they're thinking about it differently now. What's prompted this change?
So I'll say some economists are thinking about it differently. And one of the triggers for this change was a paper written by some colleagues of mine in academia. Unfortunately, not everyone's reading things that professors are writing. So that certainly helps, but that hasn't percolated
really?
Necessarily.
What?
Yeah, I know, strange. It hasn't percolated out amongst everyone. So I think, we're starting to see this change also because it's convenient. We need to borrow a lot right now to pay for this war that we're fighting against a virus. And so I think that's helped sort of change mindsets to justify the spending that we're doing. But I think ultimately a lot of the views on the debt are more political than they are economic. So, for example, if you look at who's really worried about our deficit and our debt right now, it's a lot of moderate Democrats and also a lot of Republicans. And a lot of the same Republicans voted in favor of a tax cut and a huge defense spending bill just a couple of years ago. So often it's more political than an actual economic argument.
Yeah, we'll keep going, right? Because by extension, what you're saying is it matters what you're accumulating the debt for, right? Tax cuts that are deficit financed are one thing. Recovering from a once in a century pandemic is another.
Fingers crossed.
Yeah, fingers crossed.
Yeah, that's right. And so to put it in even simpler terms, if you are throwing a baseball through windows and replacing your windows, that's not really going to support growth much fundamentally. You will boost GDP because there's a lot of activity, but it's not very productive, right?
Right.
But if you're taking that borrowing and you're investing in infrastructure and education and human capital, then that will fundamentally boost GDP over the medium to long term. So not all borrowing is the same. You're right. And I think some were worried that the stimulus checks, for example, were an example of, you know, the baseball being thrown through the window and the window constantly being replaced. Not super productive, but that, you know, the infrastructure spending, the human capital spending that the Biden folks have proposed is much more productive. So there are fewer concerns about that kind of spending than the stimmy checks.
So, you know, depending on who is in favor of the spending that will add to the debt, one of the arguments constantly trotted out is eventually all this debt is going to have to be paid and we're leaving it all to the future generations and burdening our children with it. How real is that argument?
Yeah, so the debt's never paid. you know, there's no country with no debt at all.
Thank you very much for coming to our TED Talk, Megan Green, ladies and gentlemen. Sorry, just kidding.
Yeah, some of it can be paid off, some of it expires, and so you have to pay that, but you can take out more debt to pay for it. So, you know, you don't actually have to pay off all your debt. And also a common misconception is that you have to raise money before you can spend it, that you need to collect tax revenues in order to finance spending programs. And that's also just not true. You can go ahead and spend it. You can just borrow the money and spend it and worry about tax revenue collection later. So I don't think that argument holds much water that, you know, one day this is all going to have to be paid off. That being said, if you amass a huge debt burden, then eventually it will need to be paid down or investors will strike. They'll say, no way are we lending the U.S. government any more money. And that's a problem. That's when, you know, you have IMF programs and defaults, and we absolutely want to avoid that. And so you have to pay some of the debt down. And so you can't just borrow endlessly, but you can borrow some. You don't need to expect that we're going to have to pay this all off one day.
I'm going to tread briefly into political waters here for a second. So you remember, I guess it was 10 years ago, right? Our debt was downgraded by, I think it was Moody's. And there was much hue and cry, and basically the bond markets didn't even blink. Everything went fine. And now, like a month ago, maybe, or whatever it was, Fitch came out and said, you know what, we're going to keep U.S. debt at a AAA rating, that is to say the gold standard, no pun intended, but American political dysfunction is a risk to its creditworthiness. What do you make of that?
Yeah, I mean, that was a political statement, I think, by Fitch, which is really, you know, unusual for them. That's not their lane normally. But I think, you know, there was, a hint towards the debt ceiling that we've hit now, and the suggestion that if we can't get an agreement to go ahead and lift the debt ceiling, you know, then creditworthiness would be knocked down a bit. So it was, I think, sort of an elbow jab at politicians to try to get it together and come up with an agreement, which we have yet to see, though I expect that they will.
I mean, I always feel like we have to add the caveats that these are many of the same credit ratings that thought all those mortgage-backed securities were great.
So. Yeah, it's worth taking it with a grain of salt.
Exactly.
Megan Green, an economist and senior fellow at Harvard's Kennedy School, thank you so much.
Thanks for
Megan,
having
thanks
me.
Thanks a lot. Good to talk to you again.
Thanks.
Yeah, so there you go, right? It's real, but it's not real. It's a problem, but it's not a problem. Just everybody sit tight.
It's a problem because politics makes it a problem.
Right.
Is what it really comes down to.
And what's going to happen now is that Janet Yellen is going to scrounge in the couch cushions for a billion here, a billion there, till October-ish. And then Congress, at the very last minute, is going to say, oh, yeah, that's fine. Debt limit, no worries. Right? I mean, that's the whole goat rope we're going to go through.
Yeah, but to your point about there being, your question about there being a tipping point, you know, there have been several points, you know, even just in the last couple of years, we're like, oh my gosh, there's so much debt. You know, when are investors going to stop buying our debt?
Yeah.
And there just seems to be nothing that can happen that will make investors stop buying U.S. debt. Yeah. And as long as that is a thing, you can have as much debt as you want.
Yeah, fundamentally, I think that's right.
Yeah.
All right. We're going to take a quick break. Send us your comments on the chat that Kimberly and I had with Megan Green. You can do it by sending us an email or a voice memo. MakeMeSmart@marketplace.org, of course, is the email address.
Or you can call us and leave us a voice message. Our new number is 508-827-6278, also known as 508-UBE-SMART. And we'll be right back.
With the launch of ChatGPT, Sam Altman and OpenAI reinvigorated our imaginations and fears of a world with artificial intelligence. While the company looked like a stunning success from the outside, a battle was brewing within on what the future of AI should be. Almost a year after launching ChatGPT, that battle erupted into a war when the company fired its charismatic CEO, Sam Altman. From Wondery, Business Wars is a podcast about the biggest corporate rivalries of all time. And in the newest season, host David Brown digs into the philosophical differences within OpenAI that culminated in Sam Altman's shocking firing, the chaos that followed, and what it means for the future and safety of AI in the modern world. Follow Business Wars on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus. And for more deep dive and daily business content, listen on Wondery, the destination for business podcasts, with shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, The Best One Yet, Business Movers, and many more. Wondery means business.
Get one of the most successful broadcasts in television history on your schedule with the 60 Minutes podcast. Hard-hitting investigative reports, news, and culture maker interviews and in-depth profiles are waiting for you in every episode. Listen to 60 Minutes every Sunday wherever you get your podcasts.
All right. News fix. I'll go first because mine is kind of related to the conversation.
Also, you've got like 10 links in there. Hello. Okay, four, but still.
Yeah, but they're all effectively the same thing. Which is the infrastructure bill, an actual infrastructure bill. And you know me, I half the time in meetings, I'm like, it's not an infrastructure bill. It's an infrastructure package or an infrastructure plan, because usually there is no bill. But now there is a bill. And it's a very, very long bill, 2,700 pages, which means it's chocked full of all sorts of things that probably every single member of Congress put something in that they wanted just to get everyone on board. But what that means for the oh-so-fun job of political reporters here in Washington is that there's this steady trickle of stories about things that have made it into this infrastructure package, which, to tie it back to our earlier conversation, are things that could potentially add to the deficit and later on the debt. And so we'll be, you know, bandied back and forth before there is eventually something potentially passed. And so, you know, a couple of things that have jumped out to me. There is a story in Bloomberg about all of these auto safety features that are going to be, if this passes, mandated to be put in cars as a result of this legislation, like drunk driver detections, automatic braking system, emergency braking systems, crash avoidance systems, rear guards for semi-trailer trucks, all different safety measures for passengers, some environmental initiatives like carbon capture technology and a potentially a new system of pipelines to move CO2 around the country so that it can go from, you know, coming out of polluting manufacturing facilities and end up in your soda. The Verge has a good story on that. And, you know, and then there's stuff like broadband. And surprisingly, the $65 billion being allocated to broadband, according to Roll Call, has both industry groups and digital equity advocates pretty much on board. And so I'll be fascinated, you know, in the coming days and weeks, just as various things keep coming out about what's in this. Because, yeah, it all costs money, and it's all going to have to be validated at some point.
Yeah. I think that's exactly right. There's a ton of stuff in there, 2,700 pages, and we're going to be reading about things that are in there for a good long while now. Probably even after Congress passes or the Senate passes it in the next week or two.
We'll be like, wait, that was in there too?
Right. Oh, look, surprise, massive legislation. Yeah, totally. Okay, I've got two, both of which are regulatory in nature. Number one, China. totally interesting story out of China today. David had it on the Morning Report. I haven't really heard it too many other places. The Chinese government is denouncing online gaming, and this is just such a loaded phrase, opium for the mind. And it's just, you're like, wow. First of all, they went there. Second of all, when you pair that with some of the things that the Chinese regulators have been doing about companies that have filed to go public or have gone public in the United States and some of the crackdowns they're doing on technology companies over there, it's all really, really interesting. So now online gaming is in the crosshairs. Tencent, which is one of the big companies over there, down 10% at one point today in Shanghai trading. It's really, really interesting. And you roll that in with some of the reports of the slowdown in the Chinese economy that's coming and that we've seen so far, and it's... there are more things happening over there, and China is not necessarily a place to be doing business right now. It's going to be really hard. It's going to be really hard.
Yeah, but I don't know if even China, with all of its control of its economy and citizenry, wants to upset all the gamers in China, because if yeah. you do that, what are those gamers going to do with all their free time?
Yeah. Is
probably plot
right.
something in response
right. Right.
in their fury.
Well, you know, so that's a really good analogy, right? Because what used to really trouble Chinese leadership was the idea of, at that point, 800 or 900 million peasants, and I'm using that word because that's the word in the Chinese language, right?
Mm-hmm. Nomen,
right? 800 or 900 million peasants watching the 300 million city dwellers and growing middle class have all the stuff. And now that balance has changed, right? With all the huge urban migration that's happened over there, the rural population is much smaller, the urban population is bigger, and more people are wealthy. So that tension has diffused a little bit. But now this idea of there being something else that could rile up the public, I'm sure Xi Jinping does not want that at all. At all. That was a really good point. Item number two over here, regulation. Gary Gensler, the new head of the Securities and Exchange Commission, made a set of remarks today at an Aspen Security Forum thing in which he said he is prepared to take his authorities as far as they will go to regulate and keep an eye on Bitcoin. Wild, wild west, he called it. And while Bitcoin prices are up today, actually cryptocurrency specifically is what he was talking about. Bitcoin prices are up just a little bit today. There is coming a crackdown on crypto, and people just need to be ready. People just need to be ready.
And I think it was Nancy Marshall Genzer was flagging yesterday that, and I'm going to double check this, that there is actually something in this infrastructure package to try to capture some of the not paid taxes.
Yeah,
on
yeah.
Crypto that,
yes, that's part of how they're going
to
pay for
some of
yes,
this stuff.
Yes, for
yes,
sure.
Yes, yes.
Yeah, so look, crypto's great and maybe the way of the future, but right now regulators are still trying to figure it out. And when regulators are trying to figure it out, the risk profile goes up, right? Because you don't know what is going to happen. Thus, caveat emptor is what I'm saying. That's all I'm saying. That's what I got. Little Latin on the program today.
All right. That's it for the news fix. Let's go on to the mailbag, which is not in Latin. I believe it's in English.
Hello, Molly and Kai.
It's Brianna from Phoenix.
Ivan from Brooklyn, New York.
Longtime listener, first-time voicemailer.
I want to discuss a slightly different but maybe related thing.
I was trying to look up how to say mailbag in Latin.
I was about to say, is there
time.
A word for mailbag in Latin?
There has to be. There has to be. All right. First voice
sure
memo today.
Find it for us.
A listener will send it to us. First voice memo today is about the episode we did last week on WeWork. This comes from Darian in Florida.
I listened with interest to your podcast about the WeWork fiasco, and one of the things you talked about was the guardrails in the system and around capitalism. And I was thinking about that, and part of those guardrails actually need to come from the VC firms that are looking at different opportunities and determining whether or not to, you know, give somebody some money. It seems to me they failed with those guardrails. So it all comes down to people and their perceptions and greed and, you know, all that good stuff that makes the world go around. Anyway, thanks for listening. Take care.
All that stuff.
I have to say, when I was listening to that episode, I couldn't help but thinking, I wonder if a woman or a business owner of color would have ever been given that kind of leeway to just wing it. Like, I know the answer. They wouldn't have.
Yeah.
But it...
Yeah.
It really depends on who you are.
It totally does. And here comes Adam Neumann, sweet talking SoftBank, and getting, you know, a valuation of $47 billion, internally calculated, by the way, because it was not a publicly held company. So, yeah, there were some guardrails that were not doing their job, for sure.
All right. And now to a voice message following up on the conversation both you and I had on the show and then later you and Molly had on the show about Simone Biles and the Olympics. Here's Mary in North Carolina.
It made me remember in 1996 when I was 9 years old watching Carrie Strug as part of the women's U.S. gymnastics team making that second pole vault performance on severely injured legs, looking at her coach and Bella Caroli, like, telling her to do it, and she did it for the gold medal. And I think I will never forget that. I think about it so much differently now. We've come a long way, but still have a long way to go respecting athletes, letting them be in charge of their own bodies. Thanks so much for the show. Just thought I would add that in.
Yeah, no, totally a good point about Carrie Strug, for sure.
Yeah, I hadn't thought about that moment in a while.
Remember, she had the bandaged ankle, right?
Ankle.
And the coach wound up carrying her off. Yeah, and look, people said all kinds of horrible things about what a taskmaster Bella Caroli was. So it sort of was in keeping. There was another one. After Simone Biles pulled out of the first couple of events, Dominic Mociano, who was a gymnast, I don't even know, in the 80s or 90s, whatever, showed some clip of herself. Number one, doing a balance beam routine for the Americans. She defected from Romania, I think, with her parents. Anyway, doing a balance beam routine with a stress fracture of her tibia, and then she did some flip and landed on her head, and basically wound up having to get back on the thing and keep going. And she's like, "Yeah, nobody even stopped. Nobody blinked. It was wild."
And I remember the narrative, you know, when Carrie Strug had that, you know, performance, everyone just celebrated it so much. And people were like, push through the pain, do what you have to do to win and, you know, do it for everyone else and blah, blah, blah. And it was just such a narrative about literally destroy yourself for this thing. And it's similar with the concussions in the NFL.
It's like
destroy your body for the sake of this performance and to win. And it's good that we're moving away from that because people are literally getting killed in the process.
All right, new subject. Michael in Washington, here you go.
Hi, Kai and Molly. I listen to your podcast every morning while I'm taking care of the chickens on our small farm.
Chickens. You can hear the chickens.
So I noticed that Kai is broadcasting from a shed, which makes it a Radio Shack. Well, not the strip mall version of a Radio Shack, but the Navy version of the Radio Shack, the older Navy. Not the strip mall, older Navy. You know what I mean. It's Radio Shack. I think I can explain.
Oh, man. So number one, actual chickens, which was amazing. Number two, so on Navy ships, the communications offices are called the Radio Shack because it used to be that that's where the radio was. Anyway, yes, Radio Shack. I've got a little Radio Shack in my backyard. That's what's going on. Nice one,
You
Michael.
Totally that's need a good sign. One.
I know, right?
Kai's Radio Shack.
I know. Oh, man. All right.
I love that.
This week's answer to the Make Me Smart question comes up next. And last, what is something you thought you knew you later found out you were wrong about? Who's it from? Here's it from.
Oh, John Henke. He's the CEO of Niantic. I talked to him when I was hosting Marketplace Tech a while back. And Niantic is the company behind Pokemon Go. And he was a little stuck with this question for a bit. So I volunteered that my thing that I thought I knew that I was wrong about was how to pronounce subsequently, which is subsequently, and this is what he said.
Well, I remember writing an entire college term paper very boldly using the term squid pro quo throughout, speaking of squid. And I, you know, got an A on the paper, but had a really entertaining conversation with a professor at the party at the end of the term because she thought it was hilarious that I didn't know the term, but the term quid pro quo, how to spell it. I knew what it meant, but it got mixed up along the way. So I guess that's one example of something I sure thought I was smart about that I wasn't.
There you go. I'll take that.
Yeah. So another thing he's really into, which makes sense given his involvements with Google Maps and then later Pokemon Go, is that he's super into all different kinds of maps. And another thing he mentioned that he thought he knew that he didn't, that he later found out he was wrong about, was that borders and geographic features were static. And he said they're not, you know, the edges of oceans and the locations of things move around on the planet all of the time, which you would know from your Navy days.
Yeah, that's cool.
Anyway, you can check out my full interview with him on our podcast, on your favorite podcast app, if you listen to the Marketplace Tech Podcast.
And if you don't listen, why not? That's the question. All right.
Yeah.
If you have somehow, for some reason, put off emailing or sending us a voice memo with your answer to the Make Me Smart question, just do it now. Would you call us? Leave us a voice message at our new number, 508-82-SMART, 508-UB-SMART. We appreciate that when you hook us up, because we need your help to answer that question.
Yes. Yes, we do.
Make Me Smart is produced and directed by Marissa Cabrera. Tony Wagner is our digital producer. Erica Phillips writes our newsletters, also our smart speaker skills. The intern this time around is Grace Rubin.
Today's program was engineered by Drew Jostad with mixing by Liana Squalacci. Ben Tolliday and Daniel Ramirez composed our theme music. The senior producer is Bridget Bodner, and the executive director of On Demand is Satara Nieves.
And just like that.
Look at that.
Another podcast in the can.
Yeah.
There we go.
It makes me want to, like, look at a globe again.
Really?
I used to love that.
Yeah.
Big globes and libraries and just, like...
Totally.
Especially the 3D ones.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.